Yeah, well, good morning, and I'm grateful to Tom for passing that particular hot potato over in this direction. Just take a few minutes to reply to that one. But I'm going to be focusing on policy, process, and practice. Tom's explained the view of the council as regards what it would take for public health policy to be ethically clean. We think that ethical public health policy should be in accordance with the stewardship model. That's what's the ethical benchmark. But it's no use having policies that are ethically clean if they're not also effective. So good policy, good practice requires both legitimate interventions and effective interventions. And I'm going to be saying a few words initially about effectiveness before I return to the questions of legitimacy and ethical and stewardship. The three factors that I'll pick out in relation to these first thoughts about effectiveness are to do with evidence, the evidence base for interventions, to do with the way in which professionals and lay people quite differently perceive and understand risk, and our old friends, thirdly, precaution and proportionality. First of all, evidence. Well, the report was very strong on the idea that interventions should be evidence-based. There are two dimensions to this. One is the dimension that I think you would apprehend immediately, which is that we should have good evidence about the relationship between certain practice or certain conditions and certain actions or certain diseases. In other words, if we think that using alcohol or tobacco is not conducive to good health, we should have hard evidence that supports that kind of connection. From a regulatory perspective, though, it's equally important that our interventions should be effective and that we should have an evidence base for our interventions. If we look back in the history of the 20th century, attempts to prohibit alcohol are textbook examples of interventions that go badly wrong. So outright prohibition on the evidence does not look like a smart move, even if you thought it were ethically justified. You may remember again over the summer, I think it was, certainly earlier this year, there was a story in the papers about the attempt to encourage Parisians to use their bicycles. And I think bicycles were made freely available to Parisians. But in practice, the Parisians used these bicycles to ride down the hills, leaving all the bicycles deposited at the bottom of the hills and using public transport to go back up the hills. Regulatory interventions do not always work out in the way that the regulators expect. And where we have evidence about the way things may or may not pan out in practice, then, of course, we should learn from our experience. But returning to the former sense of evidence base, which is that we want good evidence before we make these interventions, we must have a good understanding of the genealogy of diseases, understanding what it is about the environment or lifestyles or genetic makeups that contribute to these diseases, then, of course, the evidence should be on the basis of peer-reviewed work, peer-reviewed research, and ideally, we want this research to be independent, not taking a particular partisan pitch. But, of course, this ideal in practice is problematic, because even the best good faith scientific research will often be incomplete, and in good faith and reasonably contested. Later on today, there will be some discussion about fluoridation in the water. I guess this is one of the textbook cases of the evidence being deeply contested, and even when a meta-review takes place, the reviewers are unable, I think, categorically, satisfactorily, cleanly, to resolve the dispute. So our conclusion in relation to the evidence is that insofar as this is possible, we want regulators to make their decisions about health on the basis of evidence that's sound, and that everyone in the community has a stake in ensuring that the evidence base is fairly reflected, is fairly presented. So it's not just government, it's all those stakeholders who put their particular view into the play have a stake in putting it in fairly, honestly, with some integrity. Moving on to the second of the factors, there's the question of risk. Where we apprehend some risk, we think there maybe should be some intervention. There are, however, two very contrasting views about risk. One view, the statistical view, as we call it in the report, is along the following lines, that we think about the probability of the risk or hazard occurring, and we think about the severity of this if it were to occur. Now, characteristically, where the probability is low, even if the severity is high, the professionals will say this is a low-risk activity. So, for example, nuclear installations might be presented under this view as being low-risk. On the other hand, this contrasts very sharply with the view as a lay view, the social construct view, as we call this in the report, where people are much more influenced in practice by their recollections of catastrophes, and the more proximate the catastrophe, the more vivid their recollection of this, the more they think this is risky. And we don't say this in the report, but I guess many people out on the street would be extremely surprised if we were to say that nuclear installations are low-risk activities, because they'd immediately think about Chernobyl or Three Mile Island and say, moving immediately to thinking about how bad it is if things go wrong. Nevertheless, our conclusion, as far as we have a conclusion on this point, is that we prefer the statistical view to the social construct view, but of course, regulators do need to be aware that the interventions they make will be up against a view of risk out there which might be out of line with the view that is taken by the professionals. Thirdly, precaution and proportionality. The precautionary principle has had something of a honeymoon period, particularly in the context of environmental law and environmental regulation. But that honeymoon period has come to an end, and all around the patch we find people now being extremely critical of some sort of straightforward mechanical precautionary principle. People say this means many different things to different people, but crucially, it's one-eyed. If you say we must not do this because otherwise this risk will eventuate, you don't take any account then, on the face of it, of the other risks or the losses you incur as you apply this precautionary principle. That there is, as Cass Sunstein says, the need to have on the radar not just the particular risk you're focusing on, but the implications of taking that precautionary option. So the Council prefers to talk about a precautionary approach. This is not just a terminological matter. This is a substantive change of position. I don't think anybody could challenge the idea that regulators ought to be precautionary. They ought to operate with some precaution. And that when they do operate in a precautionary way, this means a full evaluation of the options available and what seem to be the costs and benefits associated with the options that are on the table. So this requires judgment. It does require case-by-case decision-making. Sometimes we might think regulators have called it wrong. And of course, ex post, we might see whether they have or not. But nevertheless, this is the kind of good faith judgment that has to be made in the light of the seriousness and urgency of the particular problem that we are considering. And this now links back to, in a minute, to stewardship. The intervention that's made needs to be proportionate. It needs to be proportionate within the precautionary analysis itself. If I can just use an example from away from public health, in the criminal justice system, we're worried about two risks. One is that we convict the innocent, and the other is that we acquit the guilty. Now, however we tilt and set up the institutional design of the criminal justice system, we have these risks in play. In England, historically, we've been very concerned not to convict the innocent, and that means that we have very high standards of due process. But of course, there's a risk with this. And all the time, we're thinking about proportionality as we adjust the system, because one risk goes up, the other risk goes down, and so on. So there needs to be a proportionate response. But the intervention needs to be proportionate in the sense that links up to stewardship, and it needs to be the least intrusive relative to the values of individual choice and intelligent, informed autonomy that is at the root of the stewardship model. So in this particular part of the report, we set out what we call the intervention ladder, and regulators should start at the bottom of this ladder. And if you are to just apply your vision, gaze at the bottom end of this ladder of intervention, starting with doing nothing, that of course might not be problematic, because doing nothing, sitting on your hands, for example with obesity, which we'll be talking about later on today, say, well, let's do nothing about it, let things go their own course, and if foresight's right, by 2050 over half the population is obese, and oh well, maybe we should have done something. But if you are going to do something, if you are going to intervene, what do you do? What's the next rung up the ladder? It is, as I think generally the government approaches alcohol control these days, to provide information, put information out there in the marketplace. Autonomy guided by information is informed choice. It's not just a matter of making crude choices, it's a matter of making informed choices. Indeed, let's go beyond that under stewardship and enable choice. Well, why don't we create options, particularly environmental, built environment options, that enable people to become more active, that they don't just get channeled without thinking about it into ways of life that are not conducive to their health, which they're not actually really choosing. It's just that they do things habitually. They're presented with a setup that doesn't enable them to act in healthy ways. Or again, we could we could change the default position. When we switch on our computers, it usually has a default setting. We're free to change it. I don't like Arial, which is what is the default position on my particular computer, so I always use Times New Roman. I have to make that move. I guess I could change the default. But defaults are hugely important in what we actually do, because we're creatures of habit. We go by the default. But we could change the default. We could change things. We could say chips. It's not the default choice on the menu. There are other choices available. We could incentivize by tax breaks. We could disincentivize. The press this morning is very agitated about disincentivizing the consumption of alcohol by increasing the price or raising taxes. We could do that. We could restrict choice in other ways by taking certain ingredients out of the food chain. Or, most drastically, we could eliminate choice, as we would where we're dealing with infectious disease and the need to quarantine compulsorily people or isolate people so they don't present the risk to others. But as we move up this intervention ladder, all the time we're cramping the choices that individuals make. Well, I say we're cramping. Sometimes it's benign, it's positive, because we're giving people more information, we're giving people more choice. This enables autonomy to flourish. But as we move up the ladder, we get to a point in those upper rungs where we clearly are now impinging on autonomy, and we need to have very good reasons for doing this. And finally, one of the elements of stewardship, in addition to protecting the vulnerable and enabling choice, one of the elements is that we should try to reduce health inequalities. This, for us in the Council, has been a very important feature of our thinking about public health policy. There are two strategies that regulators might elect to try to reduce health inequalities. One, a targeting strategy, which focuses, as it says, on the particular group who are perceived to be at a disadvantage. The other, a universal strategy, which tries across-the-board intervention. There are upsides and downsides in relation to each of these strategies, particularly if we adopt a universal strategy, although this avoids any threat about stigmatization. In practice, we suspect that universal strategies tend to improve the position of those who are better educated, make more intelligent choices, more in control of their lives. This favors better educated people, and the net effect of this might be actually to, yes, improve the level of health, but in a way that actually exacerbates the inequalities in health advantages. Our conclusion, therefore, is that, and this is not just a conclusion on this particular point, but a conclusion generally, that regulators, those who make public health policy and intervene, need to monitor the effectiveness, the impact of their interventions. They need to monitor how these strategies for reducing health inequalities are going. It's not just a matter of being smart today when you make the intervention. We need to learn the lessons from the past, and we need to keep an eye on how things are going for the future. I think that's it. Thank you very much.